across Europe. This is Previously in Europe, a podcast about what's previously in Europe. This week I'm your only host, Hugh, in London, and I'm here with nobody. This week Kieran is off, but we will have good episodes for you coming up soon about some elections that are happening. Poland's election, the second round, will probably be done next time we record. And yeah, we talk about the continued spiraling and reorganization of Macron's government. But this week, I'm here to talk to you about something that is also happening as part of our recurring segment, also happening. This week, also happening, the EU's formal commission of the GDPR. Now, that might sound super dry, but I want to iterate during this that it is important. And how it affects you was probably a zero, but how it relates to broader movements in the EU is actually quite a lot. And I think revisiting it now is a good thing to be doing, considering the resistance the EU is probably going to have on legislating all other technology and or continued enforcement of the GDPR. So the GDPR, the General Data Protections Regulation, you might be not really remembering what that is, because unless you work in tech in some form, you don't really necessarily have to interact with it. Most people would know it as the thing about the cookies. So when you go to a website and there's an annoying pop-up that's like, do you want cookies? And you're like, yes. And that lets you into the website. And I guess a lot of people know that this is relating to mostly because this is how targeted advertising works. So just generally, like, you'll have a tracking cookie on you and that'll keep track of which websites you've been to and that way, and what you've searched for instance, on Google, or what you've looked at on Facebook. And then when next time you go to Google, it can suggest something that is related to what you've seen previously. And similarly, like the sidebar on Facebook, or the when you scroll on Instagram, it'll be like, oh, that's the stuff I was just shopping for. Weird. That's slightly creepy, you might say, or mildly convenient, one or the other, probably the former. But I guess the thing with the GDPR is that, yes, it is the cookies thing, but it's also not the cookies thing. And you might think, oh, I consent to all these cookies, leave me alone, I don't care. What if I told you it's a good thing that you have to be asked about the cookies? Because while it doesn't matter in trivial examples where you might be thinking, oh, advertising doesn't really affect me anyway, if that's all it's for, it seems kind of unnecessary. But the general principle of it is quite good. So the general idea was to do what the name says. It's a general data protection regulation. So it's uniform across the EU, which is like a good thing, basically picking like a relatively strict standard and making sure everyone sticks to that works a lot better than having mysterious random standards that would be a lot more difficult to adhere to. And in practice, then no one would adhere to them at all. There would not be the lip service that people are paying to the GDPR to begin with. So basically, as of 2018, which is when GDPR properly came into force. To keep data on somebody, you have to have their consent. You have to have their explicit consent, which is why people ask you for cookies and pop-ups. But this kind of relates more generally to other ways you have data. So a lot of companies' primary way of making money is by having data on you. For instance, then cold calling you with data, or if you're like a recruitment agency, keeping like contacting you with new jobs constantly, or slightly more suspicious reasons, like collecting emails to then sell to people to make spam in the future, or just to make money, have your data as like a secondary money maker for your company that is, on the face of it, like an app that does some trivial like productivity thing, but in practice the way they make money is kind of like collecting your data. This kind of prevents that to a certain extent, because while you have to have consent, one of the other things with the GDPR is you can't keep it indefinitely without giving it explicit consent wears off. So it actually makes it a lot more difficult to just have data that you then sell on to people, for instance. There are ways around that, but that is the general principle. The other big thing about it is that they have to remove the data if you ask them to. This was also quite a big deal, because that's the kind of thing that you could imagine getting removed in like any concession to a special interest. There's like a whole host of special interests that would love to get rid of something like that. And this was generally not the way that the GDPR played out. So like with a lot of EU legislation, there often is kind of that as complaint of it, is like, well, this is so riddled with special interests carved out usually to like the major industry of a particular country. So like you see that with a lot of the farming legislation or the fisheries policies. There are countries who that affects a lot more, and their opinion matter a lot more in the scoping of it, or a lot of things that have weird caveats because back in the day, the UK, often David Cameron would like argue for like a UK exemption to some rule, which would cause the rule to become more complicated, and suddenly everyone would be asking for concessions. But this actually did turn out to be quite a broad update of what was then, like when this was being negotiated, the data protection laws the EU had were from the 1990s, and as you can imagine, were incredibly out of date, and effectively didn't touch a lot of this stuff. So you didn't really have to have consent to keep people's data. You could argue that it was part of your core business. You didn't have to justify what type of information you kept of people or who you sold it to. To any reasonable extent, because it wasn't a problem in the 90s. It was all kind of stuff that was designed for like telemarketing and stuff. It wasn't designed for the way the internet actually worked. And the goal of this was genuinely to give citizens some control over their data as kind of an additional right that they had as people who live in the EU. It actually came at quite fortuitous timing to a certain extent. So it was in the wake of the Edward Snowden revelations and the NSA was keeping track of even EU leaders' phone numbers and stuff, and had like there was rumors of them having bugs in Angela Merkel's phone. So it was kind of the people heads of the EU were quite keen to do something like quite broad and comprehensive. There's also the Cambridge Analytica scandal around the Brexit referendum had happened at the time when the votes for this happened in 2016. So it was like very clear timing for, oh, there's a big scandal about this. And then that year as well, around the time when they were going to be voting on this, Mark Zuckerberg was finally forced to come to the EU and testify on this, and then gave this really shitty testimony that didn't like answer anyone's questions or admit to any wrongdoing. And there was even the bit where he was very upfront saying like, it's ludicrous to even suggest that stuff being shared on Facebook influenced anyone's vote in the US election. You're like, well, I think you've stretched it a bit far there, Mark. I think this is causing people not to believe you. So this did actually generate quite a consensus that it was a good idea to have a pretty broad, if in some parts vague, if in some parts unenforceable, but broad as a principle, data regulation. So it passed the EU Council almost unanimously. The only country to vote against it was Austria, and they complained that it was not, in certain ways, it wasn't as strict as the 90s law. So that was their reason against it. But effectively, they were almost certainly only voting against it because they knew everyone was voting for it, and it was more of a kind of a, oh, we want to raise this point kind of thing. And then also it almost passed the parliament effectively unanimously. There was like 600 votes for it and like a handful against, which is, you know, that happens, but for something this big and sweeping, it was pretty notable. Again, especially because a lot of the people involved in negotiating it, especially on the left, who would be kind of more in the, oh, we want really strong privacy laws camp, noted that while there were strong resistances to some of the clauses in it during negotiations, we eventually ended up in a consensus that we're quite happy with, and that while there are going to be caveats and people are going to be unhappy with different parts of the rules, it's like a lot broader than anyone thought they were going to get going into negotiations. And on top of it, there was an attempt to put enforcement into it. So there were fines up to 20 million euros or 4% of global turnover, whichever is bigger, if effectively ignoring warnings was happening, which again, at the time seemed like a really big deal. It was the first and kind of continues to be the only kind of thing of this scope happening, especially at an international level. So like that sounds great. So did it work? And the answer is yeah, sort of. I mean, like you've seen all those cookie pop-ups, they're everywhere. So the EU Commission, basically, because they've been putting the Commission's done its 2-year review since the GDPR has officially been in force, and they have a very funny, very neutral infographic that totally deals with all of the problems with it, which they call GDPR, the fabric of a success story, which I just thought is like, guys, I mean, I expect you to be positive about this, but you're laying it out a bit thick to the point where you're going to be made fun of. Some things that they point out about it, like in the 2 years it's been effect, there's 22 of the EU data protection authorities have put out fines, so there's been almost 800 fines. Among those, like Google and Facebook have been issued fines. France put out a 50 million euro fine against Google very early on in 2018 about some features of Android that were non-opt-outable. But in practice, like, you know, people are kind of aware that not a lot of stuff has changed. Like a lot of the ways these companies hold data is not very transparent in a lot of ways, and they haven't done any massive moves to change it. But I guess we'll get on to like why that, some reason why that is the case kind of in a bit. They also take a point, like a paragraph, to point out that the GDPR doesn't fall into the trap that a lot of its a lot of the people lobbying against it at the time were basically saying, like, it's too rigid, and it would effectively like make everything impossible, and it's just gonna like halt any innovation or like data sharing at all. And they kind of point out that the coronavirus tracing apps have been able to be implemented, and from the commission's point of view, they're the ones that have been, given to them for looking over are all GDPR compliant, and they've managed to make them GDPR compliant. And I think that's actually quite a notable thing, because a lot of countries would have preferred to do the go the route of store all the data centrally and keep it forever as like a massive data collection enterprise. And I don't think without the GDPR, you wouldn't have had the kind of pushback you had, which was the tech companies effectively said, we want no part of this. We're not going to provide you the APIs to make this possible. But if you figure it out, technically we can't stop you. And several countries' data protection authorities did come out and say, like, this isn't compliant. So like Germany's did, and they ended up moving to a non-centrally controlled version of it, which I think is, it's good. It would have been a bad use of time. While like I work in a field that requires getting a lot of data and processing it, and it would have been great, like in healthcare, and it would have been great to have a database of loads of metadata about people in a pandemic situation. But I appreciate that not being a good idea for numerous reasons, and people pointing out it's unethical and not going down that route is good. On top of that, like, they point out that EU countries have put an effort in to spend more money on kind of local data protection enforcement of some description, like a government body you can complain to who will then investigate on your behalf if someone is illegally holding your data. They point out that there's across member states, it's on average increased by about 50% in the 2 years, which, I mean, is a big deal. I think that's a good thing to be spending government money on, and it is something that in theory does benefit people. They also love to point out, as I've said, that there no one else has comprehensive rules like this. Like, compared to the data protection in the US, this is incredibly, incredibly good, despite it not necessarily being enforced the ways people would like. They also like to point out that they've done like Eurobarometer surveys, and they say that 69% of people, are aware of GDPR. I think it's a pretty loaded stat, because they don't go into like asking the people to explain GDPR and why it's good for them. They probably just, I'd say most of those people just said, yeah, I've had pop-ups that say GDPR compliant. And there was a weird like couple of months where some US-based websites weren't available if you were in the EU, which was a bit strange, but like that's not really a thing anymore. But I'm sure that increased awareness as well. But there are issues, like there's some pretty serious issues with this. Some of the kind of like bigger picture ones that kind of the commission will cop to are the cross-border complaints don't work the way they're necessarily supposed to. There was kind of this idea at the time that you would have what they called a one-stop shop, which is basically if you have like a multi-country complaint to issue, that one country would take the lead on it. And they say there's been 141 draft decisions submitted through this system, 79 of which are final decisions. But they don't say what the number of things that should have, like, number of decisions that are pending are, which is large. So it's not necessary, like, they don't necessarily have good numbers on this. This is kind of something they acknowledge doesn't work as intended. There's also the instance very early on in this again where Dragnea was still in power in Romania. And Dragnea of currently in prison in Romania fame. So they tried to use their data protection office to demand sources from journalists. So then this investigative journalist, a journalism outfit called Rise, they effectively were they were trying to find them 20 million euros. I think they were, yeah, so they were finding the maximum they were allowed to find them, because the Fry's doesn't have a worldwide turnover of more than 20 million. So they were trying to find them basically the maximum fine if they didn't reveal their sources. Kind of, it was like, the details of it it was very transparent what they were trying to do. It was because they were investigating Dragna and his corruption, which is why he's in prison. And this was kind of, you know, from free speech advocates were rightly pointing out at the time that this was, you know, an example of the things that they warned about with the sweeping legislation, was because it created an avenue to misuse it. I would argue that that doesn't really counteract the benefits you get from it. And Dragna probably would have figured out a way to do this anyway, via like a local rule they could have put in place if there wasn't an EU-wide rule. And the EU did try to push back on this and kind of condemn this as a misuse of the law, and pointing out that there were quite vague exemptions for journalistic sources, for instance, that didn't seem to be being adhered to in the very ham-fisted, obvious attempt by Dragna to get rid of people. I mean, this was the same thing they were doing to get rid of the all the anti-corruption prosecutors in the country anyway. So it's not like they wouldn't have found something else to beat them with. So it's just kind of not necessarily a tick in its favor. I guess the main big picture issue with it is that, as a lot of people are aware, that countries like Ireland and Luxembourg are the places where a lot of big tech companies have their EU headquarters, because they've been offered favorable tax deals usually, or as Ireland would say, because they've got a really educated workforce. That's not the reason. The problem with this is that, so say you want to have a GDPR complaint about Twitter's headquarters in Ireland, so in practice you need to complain to the Irish Data Protection Office, but they don't get money from France to run that office, but they might get complaints that are due to, like, you know, data being held in France. And the scale of Twitter's reach has nothing to do with Ireland's size, but they have to foot the bill for this data protection office, which is kind of impossible. Like, the same is effectively true of Luxembourg, but it's kind of more obvious in the Irish case, because their backlog has been now well reported on, and the speed at which they're going to get through their cases, because their cases are going to be disproportionately on massive companies. Like, Microsoft is one of the world's biggest tech companies, and Google is headquartered there, and Facebook is headquartered there. So, like, realistically, this is possibly the kind of thing that could have been organized to be done centrally due to this probably quite obvious problem, because it's not like these companies weren't headquartered there in 2016. I guess I'm going along with this, there is concern, people have concern that the Irish government, you know, is possibly bendable on this issue as well, and that they're not looking to piss off the big tech companies. Like, for reference, see the pushback from the Irish government for the state aid for Apple case, where the EU pointed out that Apple owes Ireland a load of corporation tax, and Ireland doesn't want to collect it. So that's not great. And I guess, like, so it's been misused and it's bad. The GDPR needs, like, massive changes. And I would say, no, probably not. Like, so the EU needs some sort of data protection rules. And the alternative to, like, binning the GDPR and starting over is a lot worse. Because, well, one, it gives a big opportunity to take out a lot of the generality of it, which I think is generally a good thing. Having a universal, everyone technically owns their own data and therefore can ask companies to delete it principle, plus they need explicit consent to have taken it in the first place, is good. And you would end up with something that was riddled with lots of exemptions for companies that are trying to argue that their core business requires them to take a lot of data in, whereas in practice that's not often true. The kind of data you need to run most things like web apps or just apps on your phone generally is like your name, your email address, and like that, and like the password you have for that app. In most cases, they don't actually need to be collecting the data that they might want to be collecting for advertising purposes, because they'd be able to make money off it. I think a good counterexample is the EU's attempts to do copyright reform, where upload filters and link taxes were the talk, and it was very transparently in favor of particular industries, namely current copyright holders, against any attempt to make copyright fairer. It was very, very clearly not in favor of, you know, a neutral copyright reform. It was in favor of a kind of outdated version of policing for privacy purposes. And the GDPR isn't that, and it's a much less like hole punched version of protection. It's quite simple, and no one is really getting anywhere trying to soften it and arguing that like they need to relax it, because, you know, it's kind of a self-defeating argument, because they always just need to make some sort of, oh, but we need to collect that data for innovation purposes, and they never explain why that is. And you kind of need to create a straw man argument to argue that you just need to get rid of it completely. You can argue that it's not really been followed properly, and that in some ways it's not strong enough. But, you know, I think it's difficult to argue that you could take away the like data ownership aspect of it. People are trying to argue that it needs fixing, and in a way that they want to weaken it, but I think they're not really getting anywhere. But taking a look at their arguments is an example of what is going to happen when the EU does what they want to do next, which is start regulating other uses of data and things like facial recognition and other AI applications. And they're kind of putting GDPR up as an example of how you can come up with a too strict rule that means that everything grinds to a halt completely. But we know that's not reality. That hasn't happened. Like, one of the examples they use is that, contrary to what the commission says, that they say that, like, oh, people's trust in internet companies and the safety of your data online has lowered over the years. And using that as an argument that, like, well, GDPR hasn't done its job. Ignoring the counterfactual that if GDPR just wasn't there at all, what the number might be, and or if people's trust in internet companies has dropped, you want to lessen regulations on them so they can innovate harder and increase people's trust that way. It seems like a kind of, you know, you need to massively ignore a big chunk of that information for that argument to work. They were also like, there's a big gear up to kind of prevent the EU doing too much regulation on kind of AI and facial recognition and data storage for that kind of those kind of purposes, like data science purposes. And the kind of examples for that, and also going with GDPR, is that GDPR makes it hard to gather data. You need lots of data to do like machine learning, and therefore GDPR is bad, and or any legislation on what you could use the machine learning for is also bad, which is kind of, you know, like it's using the examples of, oh, data scientists think that they don't have enough data. And you're like, but did you ask the data scientists if they think it would be ethical to just collect data with no questions asked and be allowed to keep it forever and not to have it anonymized or whatever? The answer is probably no. Like most people are probably quite happy with, at least in my experience, are quite happy with, you know, that someone is looking into the broad implications of this kind of stuff. They don't want a free-for-all, because a free-for-all actually wouldn't be great for everybody. I think the main thing is that the GDPR isn't pretty, but it's the kind of most successful thing we have. and it's the best thing we've got out of data protection. It's like the only reasonable, in my opinion, data protection rule there is going. And the way it was put together, that ended up, due to things that were happening at the time, it ended up being pretty consensus-driven. And generally, I think the EU is pretty happy with how it has gone. And yes, it does need reforming, but that reforming cannot mean softening it, because that will lead to a, you know, dissolving of it pretty quickly. And you could weaken it in ways that seem subtle, like carve-outs for data collection for machine learning, but actually that would be awful for, you know, data rights generally. So the GDPR, yeah, it's happening, and it continues to happen. So that's all from us this week. We will be back with a full episode soon. Stay tuned, and thank you for listening, everybody.